Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Jack, I welcome you. There's certainly never a shortage of economic news coming along. I haven't seen a new article in case you've written one in recent days, but you can update me on your thinking on what's going on. By the way, this morning I drafted a second article on the Eurozone bailout deal. I am supremely underwhelmed by it, enough so to write two articles on it.
Well, yes, I've been pretty busy here also doing a pamphlet on the economic recovery program, what mightn't be needed for the Teamsters Union that's just finished. It's called simply An Alternative Program for Economic Recovery, and it's quite different than anything you've heard coming out. It includes focusing on jobs, the housing foreclosures, negative equity problem, and the crisis of state and local governments, three areas that the Obama administration has pretty much ignored in terms of solutions, any one of which would prevent a full, robust recovery. But all three of these, as long as we don't have a real program for jobs, housing, and local government, we're not going to get a recovery. We're going to bump along the bottom. Some quarters will get a little bit of an increase. Other quarters will be flat, as I've said many times on your show here. So if listeners are interested in that pamphlet, it's only 35 pages. It's only $5. They can email me at rasmus@kyklos.com, K-Y-K-L-O-S.com, R-E-S-M-U-S. And I'll be glad to send you a copy for the modest sum of $5. It's only 35 pages, but
Jack,
it's all programmatic.
Jack, let me just explain to listeners. The simplest way to find Jack's website is simply Google Jack Rasmus. That's the way I find your site, Jack, to access Jack Rasmus. I think there are two links, but one of them is the Kyklos one, and they can go there and they can get information on your pamphlet.
Right. You'll be able after this weekend to purchase it on PayPal as well. And, of course, my new book, Obama's Economy, which is a bigger story, full book length, not just the program, is coming out in February, published by Pluto Press and Palgrave Macmillan. It's about 300 pages, and you'll be able soon to order that on Amazon as well. And by the way, if you are an institution or union and you wish to buy bulk copies, there's discounts up to 50% on these items.
Oh, my God.
Well,
I have to form a union, Jack.
I've also been quite involved working as an economic advisor for the labor councils out here in California and helping them formulate some of these counter proposals and working with them closely. We can talk about this perhaps later, how labor is linking up here in California in particular with the Occupy Wall Street groups and providing them some significant cover and protection from the cities attempting to bust them up. You, I'm sure, have heard about the Oakland thing. Well, once that happened, San Francisco labor, I'm talking about the executive committees of the Labor Council. I'm not just talking about individual union people and individual unions even. I'm talking about the labor councils are getting involved in going to the cities and say, and telling city officials, hands off the occupiers here. Leave them alone. And if not, we'll be down there, and you're going to have to arrest us too. For example, the executive committee in San Francisco, when rumor was San Francisco police were going to break up the San Francisco Occupy after the Oakland thing just happened, went down there and sat with them all night long to prevent that. So that's a good sign. And, of course, you know, the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka, and others have strongly endorsed the Occupy Wall Street protests around the country. So it's a probably the most optimistic development in a long time to see labor linking up with with the folks who, the 99% of us, right?
Oh, absolutely, Jack. I must say that the more the police beat up on nonviolent protesters, the bigger these protests grow. They just keep spreading. They keep getting bigger. New people don't go out and stay there. New people come all the time. And there's a possibility. I've been out to the Occupy Chicago protests. There's a possibility I might get invited to speak to them. They have something here they call a teach-in. I'm not certain what day of the week it's on, or it may be a weekly thing. I'm not even sure of that, but they have it on an afternoon, and they have it indoors, where apparently they'll bring a speaker in and let the speaker address the group for 15 or 20 minutes, and then open it up to a Q&A, and I think that's a marvelous format. I do hope they'll invite me. I absolutely will go as often as they would like. And new people keep showing up all the time, Jack, so you could have one meeting, you'd have one crowd. Another meeting, you could have many new people who weren't at the previous meeting. And ordinary people need to get involved, Jack. There are lots of things. I really hope this thing mushrooms and takes off. These people literally are in the mother of all struggles, because the economy that you're talking about is what needs to be fixed. It really comes down to a situation where the politicians are in league with the bankers, and the deal from hell that they have agreed on is, we will save the bankers at the expense of wrecking the economy and harming ordinary working people. And that's the deal with the devil that Obama and the Congress signed. And that literally has to be fought and defeated.
Yes, well, you know, what you said is true, because the real issue here is not deficit cutting and debt reduction. And I think we should talk about the super committee's leaks here on the show. But it's really don't cut our bonds, our interest on our bonds, and don't raise our taxes. That's the 1%. That's the message. Deal with the deficits and the debt, which we created, not you, by cutting your program, Social Security, Medicare. People are going to be shocked when the November 23rd, when the Super Committee comes out and indicates their recommendations for an up or down vote here by Congress. We're looking at already, as you know, Obama proposed in September, coming out of the box here, $320 billion cuts. And Medicare, Medicaid alone, $300 billion, without getting anything in return. He just throws $320 billion on the table. Well, it just leaked out last week, or just a few days ago, in fact, that what we're looking at is the Democrats have proposed about $500 billion in the super committee. You know, we got 12 people there, 6 Democrats and 6 Republicans. All the Republicans are, as they have been for well over a year here, are, in solidarity with each other and not budging on the tax question. And we have 2 blue dog Democrats who are going to vote for them eventually, I think. But what we have is $785 billion the Republicans have proposed, and just cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So the Democrats are at $500 billion, and the Republicans are at $785 billion. Republican position wants $2.2 trillion total cuts. Democrats are about to say somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion. For the Democrats, they're willing to split the cuts between raising some taxes, tax loophole changes, cutting Social Security, Medicare, $500 billion, and some other cuts, defense and so forth. But the Republicans want $2.2 trillion in cuts. No cuts in defense spending whatsoever. No increases in taxes whatsoever. So all social programs, the heart of which is gutting Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. So that's what the fight is over. You see, they've always agreed, all sides, Democrats, Obama, and Tea Partiers, and mainline Republicans, they've all agreed for over a year now that the cuts have to be $4 trillion. Okay? The deficit cutting. It's just been a fight over, well, what's the composition of that? Is there going to be any increase in tax loopholes, closing tax loopholes? And in the social cuts, is there going to be any defense cutting or not? See? And the reason why we're going to come up with a deal on November 23rd, I predict, is because the automatic cuts of $1.2 trillion that were baked into the last August deal, about half of that, close to half of that, is defense cutting. Okay. The Republicans and the defense sector is not going to allow that to happen. They're lobbying furiously right now. And whatever this deal comes out with by the supercommittee in excess of $1.2 trillion automatic, it's going to have even less defense cuts in it. And those defense cuts are simply going to be cuts of winding down the operations in Iraq and later next year in Afghanistan, too. So those are already going to happen. They're going to protect the contracts, the military contracts, and they won't cut that very much, if any.
Jack,
so that's
you know,
what the
you know
real
the military,
battle in
the military budget goes up every year. Every year the defense allocation goes up, and they may scale down one operation, but they've got another one that they want to plan. There are always more wars on the books, Jack. It really is. It's a sick, sick system. And, I mean, they want to go after Syria. They want to go after Iran. They want to go after Pakistan. I mean, these wars literally will not end.
No, they won't end, but right now they're gorged on the military conflicts they have, and they've got to get through this deficit cutting and protecting corporate tax increases before they have another one. By the way, on the tax increase, what you'll see there is the Democrats are proposing to close some loopholes, but at the same time, they are in agreement, and Obama was very clear about this, cutting the top rate. Corporate and individual personal income tax rates from the current 35% each down to somewhere between 23-28%. Both sides are in agreement in doing that. So when they raise taxes by closing loopholes and reducing your mortgage deduction, which is coming, they will at the same time cut the top tax rate significantly from 35 to, about, I say, about 25-28% somewhere. So, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? $4 trillion they want to cut, they want to reduce the deficit, and they're at the same time going to give massive cuts for the wealthy 1% individuals and for the corporations. That shows you what this is really all about. It is, as I said earlier, don't touch my tax cuts, the wealthy, and don't make me take a loss on my bonds. In Europe, at least, they're talking about losses, haircuts on bonds. Okay, we got the deficit. You guys pay. My tax cuts, you guys pay. That's what it's all about.
Oh, well, there is no question, Jack, that this is to protect the wealthy in the country, the super wealthy in the country. It's to protect the bankers. It's to protect the special interests that have more than they need right now, but they never get enough. So they have more wars planned. They have great pain intended for ordinary working people. I covered this in my book, Jack, but there's stuff going on all the time. And that's right. I mean, there are at least a couple of plans floating around. One from Obama's deficit-cutting committee, as you say, to slash corporate taxes. They want to raise the retirement age on Social Security. They want to increase the co-pays on Medicaid. Impoverished people that need Medicaid, they want them to pay more, and they want to hammer Medicare recipients like myself. Obama, almost right out of the box in 2009, said he wanted to cut hundreds of billions of dollars out of Medicare. On the fraudulent reason of needing to save the system. The system is just fine if they would just keep their grubby hands off of it. And Social Security is absolutely secure. And both of them, of course, are not entitlements. They're insurance plans. And I was on Social Security as soon as I started working, Jack, but I was already working before Medicare was passed, so I was on that program, I guess, from my first paycheck.
Well, you know, all of this is a reflection. All of these proposals are a reflection of the Simpson Bulls Deficit Cutting Committee, which came out a year ago, last November, with its report and recommendations, which was for $4 trillion of cuts. And what you see debating all through this past year are different versions of Simpson-Bowles. You know, that's why the numbers have stayed the same, $4 trillion. You know, whether it's Ryan's Republican plan, $4 trillion, or whether it's Obama's plan, or what Biden agreed to in June before his negotiations broke up. You know, Vice President Biden was leading Obama's negotiations, and he agreed to $400 to $500 billion back in last June in cuts in Medicare Social Security. He agreed to that. And then, of course, negotiations broke down. And then the gang of six senators jump in July, $4 trillion. And then Obama proposes his grand deal, $4 trillion. And we get the August debt ceiling deal, only $1 trillion, you know, with another automatic 1.2. But they know the 1.2 isn't the end of the story. They know they're going to come up with more. They're going to come up with $4 trillion here, one way or another. It's just a question of the composition. And it's important to understand that the Democrats are part of this cutting deal. They're only trying to make themselves look a little more palatable by saying, well, there's got to be some loophole closing in this. But as you said, Obama from the very beginning, when he came out with his 2009 stimulus proposal, said, okay, now we got to turn around and we got to cut entitlements in order to make this happen. And then he appointed this Simpson-Bowles. You know, Simpson is this ultra-conservative ex-senator from Wyoming. He's a guy who's a co-chair of the original deficit committee that sort of gave the fundamentals of what's being discussed here. Simpson called Social Security a milk tit for $310 million. Well, that tells you where this guy's coming from, okay? And Bowles, what is Bowles? He was an advisor to Clinton. Clinton retread, who is now a director for Morgan Stanley Investment Bank.
What else?
These are the guys that he puts in charge of cutting our Social Security and our Medicare. Okay, well, of course they're going to come out with a very pro-business and the rest of you pay. I have a whole chapter in my book, Obama's Economy, on the evolution of this deficit-cutting thing. And, it's pretty clear. All the parties are in agreement. It's just, what's the mix here? You know, how much is agreed to, but what's the mix? Now, they're going to be very smart, I predict, and they will backload these cuts. In other words, the recommendations that come out in November and they vote on in December will not take effect before the election. People will not feel the hurt until right after the election. That's why my prediction of a double-dip recession is that as soon as the election's over, in the first quarter of 2013 is when the economy is going to tank again. We'll bump along the bottom and drift for the rest of this year. Come the end of the election, then things are really going to get rough.
Oh, I think that's right on, Jack. There's no way they're going to mess up their election, and Obama's got a lot going for him. He has no credible Republican candidate, whoever gets nominated, to run against him, unless somebody pops up that isn't in the race right now that has more credibility than the lineup that the Republicans have right now. And I compared them in one article. On Rick Perry. I wrote another one on Michelle Bachmann, but I think it was in the Perry article that I compared the Republican aspirants. I said they look more like a police lineup than a legitimate group of presidential candidates. I literally can't believe how bad they are. But was McCain any better in 2008? That was a setup for Obama. Obama was chosen to become president. I think he's chosen to be reelected, and he's got everything going for him. I mean, he's done nothing to help ordinary people, but he's got these protests around the country. He's trying to parlay them to believe that he actually supports what they're doing. My God, do people actually believe that garbage? Well, I'm afraid too many do, Jack. It's shocking and it's shameful because Obama literally doesn't give a damn about ordinary people. If he did, he would have done something for the last 3 years. He hasn't done a damn thing for working people.
Well, that's pretty much the fact. Nothing done for foreclosures, and this thing that came out a week or so ago about negative equity to help those refinance negative equity. Well, you might be in negative equity, but you got to be current for 6 months in all your payments and so forth to even be eligible.
Geez.
And it's still voluntary, and you know, it's just a token thing. What we see is token measures coming out, campaign measures, not really serious measures here to address jobs, housing, and state and local governments.
Jack, if they wanted to help on housing alone, they could simply mandate no more foreclosures. Anybody who cannot make payments on their mortgage legitimately can stay in their homes, and the bankers cannot throw you out and take your home. Maybe if they own more equity in it than you do, they can claim ownership, but you can stay in your home and work out some kind of a basis, pay rent, anything you can afford, but nobody's going to be thrown out on the street and wonder, where on earth am I going to be able to find a roof to put over my head? I haven't heard a whiff of that even proposed by the media. Nothing. That would be a sensible thing to do.
Well, you know, simply saying no more foreclosures or no repossessions, you're saying no repossessions, that doesn't really solve the problem.
Oh, it doesn't.
That may prevent it from getting worse, but where is the program rewriting these loans and reducing principal and interest so people could afford to stay in them?
Oh, absolutely.
Where's that program? You know, we even did that in the 1980s, you know, Resolution Trust Corporation. You know, renegotiated principal and interest on some homeowners. And, of course, in the 30s, it was the Homeowners Loan Corporation where the government came in, HOLC came in, and told these mortgage companies, well, you're defunct. Give us your paper, the mortgages. Get out of here. We'll give you some token payment. And the government took it over, and the government went and reduced principal and interest so people could stay in their homes. That's what you have to have now. You have to have a new homeowners loan corporation.
Oh, I agree.
That would do just that.
I absolutely agree, Jack. I mean, a legitimate program that literally is going to help me. As a stopgap, you know, you come into the emergency room with a gaping wound. You got to stop the bleeding. So no foreclosure, no more foreclosures. That stops the bleeding. But to heal a patient, you need a credible program like the program of the 1930s, where literally, if the bankers can't do it on their own, then the government takes over the program and they come up with a credible program to really help people and straighten out the mess. Instead, we have this horrific housing depression going on. It just seems to go on with no bottom.
Well, there is no light at the end of the tunnel for housing. It's 75% down, and there's no indication of any recovery because there's been no serious programs to deal with it now for 3 years. Just like, you know, we have the same number of unemployed, 26 million, we had in June 2009. It hasn't changed because there's no real program. The only program for job recovery, job creation, has been more tax cuts, more tax cuts, more tax cuts for business. And, of course, that doesn't create any jobs. So no real jobs program, which, by the way, in my alternative program booklet, I define in great detail what needs to be done to create 17 million jobs. As well as what needs to be done in the housing sector, which is not just what we've been talking about, but for everybody who has a mortgage or is about to have a mortgage, we got to take mortgages and consumer credit out of the hands of the banks by creating a utility banking system. But that's
Amen.
All in the pamphlet if people are interested in it, and also in my book in the whole last chapter. But, you know, the problems aren't really addressed and won't be addressed now. And I'm not so optimistic as you that, you know, the cast of characters on the Republican side, as terrible as they are, you know, won't give Obama a serious run for the money. There's only really one candidate that could, and that's Romney. All the rest are jokers, you know, and all the rest are just pandering. Stumbling over themselves to figure out how to give even more money in tax cuts to corporations and how to curry the favor of all the crazy right-wingers out there. The Tea Partiers, in other words, the worst of the Tea Partiers. It's a cast of characters, that's for sure. But the problem Obama has is that, you know, just look at his ratings. They're really pretty low, and they're falling, as is Congress. Only 9% approval of Congress.
Yeah, amazing.
I mean, the people are really, really upset out here, and they just may vote against none of the above.
Well, they may
plague on all of their houses.
They may sit on their hands and not come out. I mean,
that's
I
right.
saw something in recent days that black people still overwhelmingly approve of Obama. I simply can't understand why, because black people, an awful lot of poor people, are black, and they are hurting more than people who have jobs. I mean, they are really hurting badly. After 3 years of Obama, don't they realize that he has done nothing for them? That he doesn't care about black people? He may talk the talk, as they say, but he certainly is doing nothing to help his own people, and he spurned them again right out of the box. So why they would support him, I simply can't understand, unless there were spurious numbers being reported. And the same would be true of Latinos. I mean, he has deported more Latinos than George mm-hmm. Bush ever did. I mean, Latinos should hate him.
And it's not just deportations. He's broken up families. He's destroyed lives, you know, with these really almost terroristic kind of DEA raids and so forth.
Absolutely.
And has he come out and said anything about the draconian stuff going on in Alabama? Not a word. No, I don't think Latinos are going to be fooled by what he's done, and now he's turning around trying to just appeal to them in one more year. I mean, it looks like what's he really serious about, you know? But my fundamental point is I'm not so sure that Obama won't lose this election. It all depends on whether the economy is worse a year from now. And, of course, it depends to some extent on who the Republican candidate is. But I think it will be Romney here. I don't think any of the others are really contenders.
Although there is a possibility that we will get a dark horse that will enter the race. I'm old enough to remember, I don't know when he came in, but I remember the 1952 presidential race, Adlai Stevenson for the Democrats, and Dwight Eisenhower was the Republican candidate. But it seems to me that he came into the race late. Both parties wanted him to be their standard bearer, and he went with the Republicans, not the Democrats. But I think he came in a little bit on the late side. And Stevenson was a credible candidate, but Eisenhower in 1952, 7 years after World War II ended, it pretty much was a slam dunk for him. And one comment, Jack, we'll get close to break time. I remember reading a quote from a woman who walked up to Stevenson after he gave a campaign speech, and she said something like, "Governor," he was the governor of Illinois, "Governor, all thoughtful voters will support you." And he said, "Well, thank you, madam. Unfortunately, we need a majority." But we went from Adlai Stevenson, who I remember very well, I didn't live in Illinois at the time, and Dwight Eisenhower to whichever of the Republicans gets the nomination, and Obama, and of course before him it was Bush or McCain. And I mean, these are the kind of people who represent the country today. It's pretty discouraging, Jack. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back, and I'll let you pick up with more on the economy. If you've got some thoughts on the Eurozone deal, I'd love to hear that as well.
Yes, let's talk about that, yes.
We'll be right back. Jack Rasmus. Oh, excuse me, clear a frog out of my throat. Jack, let me just mention your latest book and your newest coming out. Jack's latest book is called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. His new book coming out in February called Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few, the way the policies are running, Jack, so counterproductive, the policy, namely, wreck the economy but save the bankers. You may have to change your title again to Recovery for the Extremely Very Few. because things are even worse than I imagined they would be when this book was due to come out. I mean, how they expect to create any kind of prosperity, even for people somewhat well off. You would think that people earning some reasonable amounts of money who simply don't share in the super wealth that the big boys get, like the Wall Street types or the other corporate CEOs, you would think they would be mad because they may not be doing as well as they might have in previous years when there were more responsible policies by people running the country. But literally, they're just simply not doing anything to create economic growth. That's one of the problems I find with the Eurozone bailout deal. Again, the idea is save the bankers, to hell with the economies.
Yes, well, you know, one of the reasons we don't have a recovery is because the three Obama recovery programs of the last 3 years have been insufficient in magnitude. In other words, there hasn't been enough real spending, but it's not just the magnitude of spending. This is where I differ with the Keynesians. It's also the composition. It's been heavily tax cuts and or subsidies to state and local government that were temporary and are now gone. No real programs to create jobs and to solve the housing problem and to permanently resolve the state and local government crisis problem. And we got a little bit of a bump in the economy in the first year, and that sagged in the summer of 2010. Then we got another little stimulus that had even less effect, and now Obama proposed another $447 billion, of which about $300 billion of which is tax cuts again. You know, his second program last December was $857 billion. You know, the first one in February 2009 was $862 billion, half of which were tax cuts. The second one in December of last year, $857 billion, of $800 billion of which were tax cuts. It's all tax cuts, tax cuts. And, of course, it's not creating jobs. It's fattening corporate coffers. Well, they're sitting on, U.S. companies are sitting on $2 trillion of cash, not spending it. See, that was they're supposed to do. After the big tax cuts for them and subsidies to prevent a further collapse of the states for 1 year, they were supposed to turn around and invest this stuff, but they aren't. They're sitting on the cash, $2 trillion. Multinational companies have another $1.4 trillion offshore. The banks have been bailed out, and they're not lending to small business. They're sitting on $1.7 trillion. There's over $5 trillion just bottled up out there. See, the country's not broke. It's just all bottled up in the banks and in the wealthy investors, and they aren't doing their part, so we're not getting a recovery for the rest of Main Street. Now, that ought to tell you how the programs have failed and what needs to be done, to turn it around. I mean, it's not that complicated, and we are not broke. And now, of course, what we see, though, is, all these bailouts and the wars and the Bush tax cuts extensions and everything have caused this $9 trillion debt run-up since 2000. And now it's all about, who's going to pay for that? And they're going to enter an austerity, which we already have, policy period here. And what little stimulus we got out of the 2009-10 tax cuts and spending by Obama are now going to be reversed. This is reverse even the modest stimulus that we had. And it's really amazing how they're about to shoot themselves in the foot in terms of economic recovery. But that's the picture, and that's what I call an epic recession, where you just bounce along the bottom and you don't get any sustained recovery. You don't fall into depression yet until we get another banking crisis, then we will. But this could go on for years, and a lot more than 3 years. We could be looking at 7-10 years of this possibly as well. Let's talk about Europe, because Europe's the wild card,
Jack,
right?
Let me throw in one comment first. I heard an interview on Russia Today with an Australian economist, Steve King. I forget what university he's affiliated with. I know who he is. And it's the first time that I've heard and seen him interviewed. He thinks that the policies are so counterproductive that what's going on now could literally throw us into a debacle for two decades. I mean, it was the direst forecast that I've heard. He really sees serious trouble, and it won't end for two decades. I mean, my God, I'm 77 years old. If he's right, I won't live to see the end of it.
Well, I don't know that anyone can predict that far out. I would be hesitant doing that. I think, you know, predictions, given the instability of the system right now, are pretty risky when you get out beyond a couple years.
Oh, indeed.
But I think it's pretty clear if these austerity cuts go into effect before the end of the year, which they will, that will pretty much reverse any of the stimulus we've had to date, which was already inadequate. And composition was already bad, and the timing was bad, not just the magnitude of the spending. And it will clearly reverse all of that. But the reversal will take effect in 2013, you see, as I said. They're going to drift along for another year here without it getting much worse and not getting any better. But then the bottom, I predict, is, and have always predicted, and even in my Epic Recession book, that the 2013 to 15 period is the period in which you've got to look for a double dip. And then if we get a second banking crash, which is building in Europe, and this settlement is not going to stop it, then you have a string of banking collapses and crashes, and that's what a depression is. It's just a string of financial crashes that drive the economy down to lower and lower levels. But watch Europe. That's the key right now. Europe is far more unstable than even the U.S. But the U.S. banks and financial system is very much tied into the European situation through the major banks in France and Germany. And of course, the French banks are tied up with Greek, Italian, and Spanish debt, particularly Italian and Spanish debt. And if those countries have a problem, then the French banks go under, and that pulls down the rest of the banking system. That's why Sarkozy is running back and forth to Berlin, talking with Merkel here on trying to forge something. He needs something to change the psychology around, which is that, oh, the French banks are in trouble. Let's start betting on the French banks collapsing. And, of course, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But that's exactly what's happening in Europe. They're trying to protect the French banks. Dexia, the Belgian bank, closely tied with the French banks, already had to be restructured. But the big French banks are really in trouble. Crédit Agricole, and Paribas, BNP Paribas, and of course even the Swiss bank UBS, and in the UK it's Barclays, and Deutsche Bank, and Commerce Bank in Germany. These are all the big banks that are in trouble right now because of this debt problem.
Oh, indeed so, Jack, and I've written a little bit about it myself, and they're all interlinked because they own each other's debt. And, just a small country like Greece has, $350 billion or so in debt, and this stuff is owned by these troubled banks.
Well, and, that's what they report, 350. I think there's more.
Oh, my goodness, if it's more than that, it's
and that's just
even worse.
Greece. I think it's $500 to $600 billion.
Oh.
Is the problem in
for
Greece.
A tiny country like
and
Greece.
Of course, Italy is you're talking about trillions. You see, what they've come up with, originally they had about 450 billion euros as a bailout fund there, but it became pretty obvious that wasn't going to be enough. And they've thrown in another about trillion dollars. So they have a bailout fund now of 1.4 trillion, but the real bailout potential that they're going to need is somewhere above 5 trillion. You know, 1.4 trillion isn't going to do it. So what they're doing with their stabilization fund, now that they threw another trillion in there, is they're going to leverage it. They're going to provide guarantees to private investors of 25% if the private investors throw their money in too, which is, you know, an indication that the real number, you know, if 1.4 trillion is 25%, so, you know, what's another 4.2? You're looking at the other 75%. You're looking at about $5 to $6 trillion is what they need potential losses that they're facing over there in Europe.
But they haven't got that kind of money, Jack. If they try to come up with that, they will wreck their own economies. I can't imagine Germany being party to a deal like that.
No, Germany won't. But see, what they're doing is trying to leverage that $1.4 trillion and get private investors. In particular, they're trying to get China and Japan and the petro economies to sovereign wealth funds to throw in the money.
Jack, my understanding
is... 75%, or at least part of the 75%.
My understanding is they've come up with, I forget the precise number, it might be $350 billion, and that will be leveraged up to a little bit under $1.4 trillion. So that would be the leveraged amount, but the sick economies, the five pigs countries, that debt level may be somewhere on the order of $6 trillion. So they're really... If they leverage it fully, the way they're explaining it, with very unclear details, and really they need to be worked out. So they've given themselves a deadline to the end of November to do it. But in the article that I drafted this morning, it said that some analysts think they could be haggling over this for many weeks, maybe months, because there's a lot of disagreement, especially between France and Germany. Both countries have completely different agendas, and the president of the Bundesbank, the German bank that was the central bank before the ECB, very, very unhappy with this deal. He made some very harsh comments about it, and if it's coming from a man like that, it's coming from others as well. So the deal that I try to explain in two articles, I had to also explain that an awful lot about this is left to be worked out later, so we really don't know what in the devil they're going to come up with, and at this point, they may not know what they're going to come up with either.
Yes, well, as you say, it's not very clear whether they're leveraging up to $1.4 trillion or whether they will put $1.4 trillion in and leverage beyond that. I think it may be both cases. And then there's this 50% haircut that those who are holding Greek debt, investors holding Greek debt, are supposed to take. But, you know, that 50% haircut is total voluntary. And there's no requirement that these investors, these bondholders, are really going to agree to a 50% haircut. That's what's been recommended, but there's still uncertainty regarding that. And then they turn around and they say, okay, 50% haircut, you bond investors, and then we want you to come back in and buy some of the new bonds we're going to create, bailout bonds, and we'll insure your against losses of 25% if you buy the new bonds. So they're telling them to take a haircut on Greek and come in and buy new bonds, which is nonsense. You know, they're not going to buy the new bonds after they have to take a haircut. But that's what the negotiations are about. In other words, we may agree to less of a haircut in exchange. We'll buy some of the new bonds. So that's where the core of the negotiations continuing are going to be over that with private bondholders.
Well, it strikes me a little bit as the gang that can't shoot straight, or if they can't really come up with a credible deal, they'll just game the system, Jack, to come up with anything, say anything. And
they're buying time right now with this thing, because sentiment and confidence was collapsing. You know, if they didn't come up with something, it's quite possible that we would have seen this week a significant further collapse of the stock markets.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. And even though a deal was priced into the markets, it's incredible that the markets rallied so strongly on a deal with no details, and mm-hmm. a deal agreed on was already priced into the markets. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, it shows how manipulated the markets are, and the economy is still very fragile, very weak. There's nothing to cheer about, and I read this morning, there's still one day in October to go, but so far in October, with one day remaining, October has risen, either the S&P or the Dow, or maybe both of them. October has had its best October in 25 years. 25 years? Well, my God, I mean, this is at a time the economy is weak, literally teetering on cratering, and October is up over 11% on the S&P, on the Dow. That is absolutely crazy. Talk about 25 years, let's call it a 300-to-1 shot. Would you bet your money on a 300-to-1 shot? I don't think any sane, well, people do it. They buy lottery tickets. But
a lot of big investors did do it. But, with the intention of reselling that, once they make those expected profits, the market can go down just as fast as it went up in October.
Oh, absolutely. Have to get a big parabolic rise, Jack. There's a big, big reversal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have a significant decline a month somewhere in the near future, equal to what will happen in October. But, you got to factor in what's causing investors to do this. One is they were worried about the European situation, and now for the short term, meaning a week or two, it looks like it's stabilized a little bit. Well, now's the time to bet on some stock appreciation, which they're doing. And behind the picture, of course, is the Federal Reserve is finally throwing more money in once again into the economy. And there's talk of about even another QE3, which means even more. And if you look at what's happened in the last 3 years, this stock market in the U.S. surges on whenever the Fed jumps in and buys bonds, and it collapses when the Fed stops buying bonds. In other words, we have a stock market that's totally dependent on Fed liquidity injections for 3 years now. So whenever you see that happening, the Fed going in and buying, expect stocks to rise. And when you see the Fed finishing the buying or talking about stopping, then the stock market will come down again. And that's exactly the seesaw that we see going on with the U.S. stock market.
But you can only throw money at this thing so long when you literally don't have a sound economy. And it's amazing, Jack, we have these debates about curbing the national debt and the budget deficit. And no matter what they cut, the deficit keeps rising month after month after month. If they really wanted to do something, they could do something responsible. Well, there are obvious responsible things
they could do. You could solve the deficit problem overnight, you see, because 60% of the deficit is due to insufficient tax revenues. And that's due to two things. One, we can't get the economy going. We've got 26 million unemployed. Okay, they're not paying taxes, and their businesses aren't paying taxes. And secondly, we have this horrendous Bush tax cuts that cost us about $250 billion a year. You know, if they extend these Bush tax cuts 8 more years, that's going to cost us another $2 trillion. So if your targeted deficit cutting is $4 trillion, you could solve half of that deficit cutting by just repealing the Bush tax cuts. There's $2 trillion right there. Right? So then you only have $2 trillion to deal with. Get the economy going. Get people back to reasonable jobs here instead of 26 million unemployed. There's another $1 trillion. So you only got $1 trillion left that you got to deal with. Well, that's the defense spending. It's very simple. I got an article coming out. What are the real causes of the debt, the deficit and debt? Over the last decade, we started with $5.6 trillion in 2000. We're at $14.8 trillion today, so about $9 trillion run up. $2.1 trillion of that is runaway defense costs, not just the wars, but runaway Pentagon spending. $2.9 trillion of that is the Bush tax cut. So there's $5 trillion. $3 trillion in bailouts that didn't get us a recovery. There's $8 trillion, and then the rest is runaway health care costs that are causing a crisis in Medicare and Medicaid, and then interest on it. I mean, there's your $9 trillion right there. You would think if that was the cost, people would focus on those four items. But no, they're not focusing on those four items because the defense industry wants to keep its hand in the pie, and the rich folks who've got $3.4 trillion in tax cuts don't want them taken away. And the banks who got bailed out don't want to pay anything back in terms of bank tax or financial transaction tax. So they're turning around and they're taking it out on everybody else, on the 99%. They're taking it out on everybody else to make everyone else pay. But there's only five causes, and I've just talked about them. And if you were serious about the deficit and debt, you would target those five causes. And you could wipe out half of it over the next decade by simply immediately saying, you know, no more Bush tax cuts, which is what Obama ran on in his campaign in 2008. The main reason, the main way he was going to finance his economic stimulus program, as he said many times during the election, was we're immediately going to stop the Bush tax cuts and we're going to immediately cut the wars. Those two things would have allowed him to have had an even bigger stimulus package in 2009 that would not have touched the deficit $1. But, of course, he totally reneged on both of those items, didn't he? And when he reneged on them, he had no money to pay for the stimulus, which meant he had to borrow $3 trillion, which added to the deficit. See, this is not rocket science. It's pretty simple what happened and why we are in this deep, deep hole. But the political problem is they, the 1%, do not want to pay for, you know, the tax cuts and the wars and so forth that they caused. They want us to pay for it all. That's the fight. It's our entitlement, our Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, versus their tax cuts. That's what it's all about.
Well, their tax cuts, Jack, and their wars, and their banker bailouts, and their handouts to other corporate favorites, it's the same dirty game, except the numbers keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and Everett Dirksen once talked about a billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon we're talking about real money. Well, fast forward a few decades, and now we say a trillion here and a trillion there, and pretty soon we're talking about big money. What will they say 20 years from now, Jack? Heavens, a quadrillion here, a quadrillion, well, if we get hyperinflation, indeed, a quadrillion here, a quadrillion there. Bad policy just seems to beget more bad policy, Jack, and we get a bad situation that corrupt politicians in league with predatory corporate bandits just make things worse, and ordinary people suffer so much, and that's why 26 million people, as you say, are out of work, and nobody in the major media talks about this. Instead, they report the fictitious numbers that have no meaning at all. There's nothing said about the extreme suffering going on in the country. I mean, why in hell are people just literally raging against the system on streets, sleeping out in them, going through, putting up with police beatings? Why on earth are they out there if they weren't mad at hell about being abused so badly for so long and nobody cares about them? So they're expressing their views nonviolently. I wonder how long it'll stay nonviolent, Jack.
Well, I guess we will see. You're absolutely correct. People are out there. It's not just kids running around. I've been out to the Occupy Wall Street sites and talked to folks and so forth. A lot of people without jobs, a lot of people who got foreclosed, a lot of students whose tuition is going up double digits for the last 3 years and who are indentured in student debt, and just folks with real legitimate economic complaints. It's a broad spectrum, and some of these Occupy Wall Street things are beginning to happen in suburbia even. So you're absolutely correct. It's a reflection of real economic conditions, and people are just really frustrated and really, really angry. I think the politicians underestimate how angry folks are, and there's nothing being done except cut the deficit. I mean, you know, and you're going to see the retirees join this thing when it comes down here and before the end of the year, and cuts in Medicare and Medicaid, and then Social Security after that.
Jack, absolutely. I'm afraid we're out of time. My feeling is I wish everybody would get out, and everybody doesn't go out and stay out all the time. So there needs to be a lot of new people coming in. Other people need to take a pause. You think that you'd want to go home and take a shower, have a hot meal. People need to do this and recharge themselves. But this really is a battle royal. I hope I do get a chance to speak, Jack. I'll be very, very forthright with people, and I will really lay it on the line as best I can.
What you need to do, Stephen, is we need to get labor and others to help these Occupy Wall Streets clarify their demands, because unless you come up with demands on the system, you will just dissipate.
You will dissipate. They have a lot of grievances, but they need to cite specific things that
That's
they
right.
want done.
I'll send you a copy of my my pamphlet, An Alternative Program for Economic Recovery.
Oh, I appreciate that, Jack.
Okay.
I will spread the word around about it, and I hope we can get back. I'm going to send you an email, and we've got Thanksgiving coming up end of November. Let's see if we can work out a day to get you on, because I really want to have fresh programming. Even though Progressive Radio will not have anything live, I want to pre-record so I don't run repeat programs over the holidays, and the same will be true for Christmas. Anyway, Jack, thanks. I'll shoot you an email right now.
Okay.
And do join us tomorrow, same time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.